given me, a tunnel under the causeway that ended in a sheep pasture. Not much of use. Who were they? Would they be willing to help us?
I don't know. Even now I can't recall it clearly.
You must, I told him. I felt him flinch and feared I had pushed him too hard. I spoke more gently. Fool, you are all I have, and there is so much I need to know about this. For I must know their weaknesses, their pleasures, their friends. I must know their habits, their vices, their routines and desires. I waited. He remained silent. I tried another question. If we can choose but one to kill, which one do you most wish dead? He was silent. After a time, I asked him quietly, Are you awake?
Awake? Yes.
He sounded more sober than he had.
Fitz, was this how it was with Shade? Did you two take counsel with each other and plan each death?
Don't talk about this. Too private even to tell the fool. I'd never spoken of it to Molly. The only one who had ever witnessed me engaged in my trade was B. I cleared my throat. Let it go for tonight, fool. Tomorrow I will beg paper from the keepers, and we can begin to draw the stronghold, as much as you remember. For tonight, we need to sleep.
I won't be able to.
He sounded desperately unhappy. I was exhuming all he had buried. I handed him the bottle. He drank from the neck. I took it back and did the same. It was unlikely that I would sleep either. I hadn't intended to get drunk. It was supposed to be a ploy, a scheme to trick my friend. I drank more and took a breath. Have you any allies there, within the walls?
Perhaps. Frilkop was alive the last time I saw him, but if he lives, he is likely a prisoner.
A pause.
I will try to order it all in my mind and tell it to you. But it is hard, Fitz. There are things I can't bear to recall. They only come back to me in nightmares.
He fell silent. Digging information out of him felt as cruel as digging bits of bone from a wound.
When we left Aslavior to return to Clarys,
he said suddenly,
that was Prilkop's idea. I was still recovering from all that had happened. I did not feel competent to chart my own course. He had always wanted to return to Clarys, longed for it for so many years. His memories of that place were so different from mine. He had come from a time before the servants were corrupt, from a time when they truly served the White Prophet. When I told him of my time there, of how I had been treated, he was aghast, and more determined than ever that we must return to set things right.
He shifted suddenly, wrapping his arms around himself and hunching his shoulders forward. I rolled toward him. In the faint light of the ceiling stars, he looked very old and small.
I let him persuade me. He was, I hope he is, very large-hearted, Fitz. Unable, even after he had seen all Illistor did, to believe that the servants now served only greed and hatred.
Illistor?
You knew her as the Pale Woman.
I did not know she had another name. At that, a thin smile curved his mouth.
You thought that when she was a babe, she was called the Pale Woman?
No, I'd never really thought about it. You called her the Pale Woman.
I did. It's an old tradition, or perhaps a superstition. Never call something by its true name if you wish to avoid calling its attention to you. Perhaps it goes back to the days when dragons and humans commonly coexisted in the world. Tintaglia disliked that humans knew her true name.
Illistor, I said softly.
She's gone. Even so, I avoid her name.
She is gone. I thought of her as I had last seen her, her arms ending in blackened sticks of bone, her hair lank about her face, all pretense of beauty, vanished. I did not want to think of that. I was grateful when he began to speak again, his words soft at the edges.
When I first returned to Clary's with Prilcop, servants were astonished. I have told you how weak I was. Had I been myself, I would have been much more cautious. But Prilcop anticipated only peace and comfort and a wonderful homecoming. We crossed the causeway together, and all who saw his gleaming black skin knew what he must be, a prophet who had achieved his life's work. We entered, and he refused to wait. We walked straight into the audience chamber of the four.
I watched his face in the dim light. A smile tried to form, faded.
They were speechless, frightened perhaps. He announced plainly that their false prophet had failed, and that we had released ice fire into the world. He was fearless.
He turned toward me.
A woman screamed and ran from the room. I cannot be sure, but I think that was Dwalia. That was how she heard that the pale woman's hands had been eaten, and how she had died in the cold, starved and freezing. Ilistor had always despised me, and that day I secured Dwalia's hatred as well. Yet almost immediately the four gave us a veritable festival of welcome, elaborate dinners with us seated at the high table with them. Entertainments were staged, and intoxicants and courtesans offered to us anything they imagined we might desire. We were hailed as returning heroes, rather than the two who had destroyed the future they had sought.
Another silence. Then he took a breath.
They were clever. They requested a full accounting of all I had accomplished, as one might expect they would. They put scribes at my disposal, offered me the finest paper, beautiful inks and brushes, so that I might record all I had experienced out in the greater world. Prilcop was honored as the eldest of all whites.
He stopped speaking, and I thought he had drowsed off. I had not had nearly as much brandy as he had. My ploy had worked too well. I took the teacup from his lax hand and set it gently on the floor.
They gave us sumptuous chambers,
he went on at last.
Healers tended me. I regained my strength. They were so humble, so apologetic for how they had doubted me, so willing to learn. They asked me so many questions. I realized one day that, despite all their questions and flattery, I had managed to minimize you, to tell my history as if you were several people rather than one. A stable boy, a bastard prince, an assassin, to keep you hidden from them, save as a nameless catalyst who served me. I allowed myself to admit that I did not trust them, that I had never forgotten or forgiven how they had mistreated and restrained me. And Prilcop, too, had misgivings. He had watched the pale woman for years, as she claimed Aslevyol. He had seen how she courted her catalyst, Keeble Rawbread, with gifts, a silver throatpiece, earrings of gold set with rubies, gifts that meant that she had substantial wealth at her disposal. The wealth of Clary's had been made available to her that she might set the world on their so-called true path. She was no rogue prophet, but their emissary, sent out to do their will. She was to destroy Icefire and put an end to the last hope to restore dragons to the world. Why, he asked me, would they welcome the two who had dashed their plans? So we conspired. We agreed that we must not give them any clues that led back to you. Prilcop theorized that they were looking for what he called junctions, places and people that had helped us shift the world into a better future. He speculated that they could use the same places and people to push the world back into the true path they had desired. Prilcop felt you were a very powerful junction, one to be protected. At that point, the four were still treating us as honored guests. We had the best of everything, and freedom to roam the castle and the town. That was when we smuggled out our first two messengers. They were to seek you out and warn you.
I rallied my bleary brain. No, the messenger said you wanted me to find the unexpected son.
That came later, he said softly. Much later.
You always said I was the unexpected son.
So I thought then, and Prilcop too. You will recall how earnestly he advised us to part, lest we accidentally continue to work unpredictable change in the world, changes we could neither predict nor control.
He laughed uneasily.
And so we have done.
Fool, I care nothing for anyone's vision of a better future for this world. The servants destroyed my child. I spoke into the darkness. I care only that they have no future at all. I shifted in the bed. When did you stop believing that I was the unexpected son? And if those prophecies do not pertain to me, what of all we did together? If we were guided by your dreams, and yet I was not the one your dreams foretold.
I've wrestled with that.
He sighed so heavily I felt his breath against my face.
Prophetic dreams are riddling things, Fitz. Puzzles to be solved. Often enough you have accused me of interpreting them after the fact, bending them to fit what truly happened. But the prophecies of the unexpected son? There are many. I have never told you all of them. In some you wore a buck's antlers, in others you howled like a wolf. The dream said you would come from the north, from a pale mother and dark father. All those prophecies fit. I cited all those dreams to prove that the bastard prince that I had aided was the unexpected son.
You aided me? I thought I was your catalyst.
You were. Don't interrupt. This is difficult enough without interruptions.
He paused again to lift the bottle. As he lowered it, I caught it before it fell.
I know you are the unexpected son. In my bones I knew it then, and I know it now. But they insisted you were not. They hurt me so badly that I could not believe what I knew. They twisted my thoughts, Fitz, just as much as they talked my bones. They said that some of their Clary's bred whites were still having dreams of the unexpected son. They dreamed him as a figure of dark vengeance. They said that if I had fulfilled those prophecies, the dreams would not be continuing. But they were.
Maybe they still mean me. I stopped the bottle and lowered it carefully to the floor. I set my glass beside it. I rolled to face him. I had meant it as a jest. His sharp intake of breath told me it was anything but humorous to him.
But,
he objected, and then stopped speaking. He bowed his head forward suddenly, almost butting it into my chest. He whispered as if he feared to speak the words loud.
Then they would know. They would certainly know. Oh, Fitz. They did come and find you. They took B, but they had found the unexpected son, as they had claimed the dreams predicted they would.
He choked on those last words. I set my hand on his shoulder. He was shaking. I spoke quietly. So they found me, and we will make them very sorry they did. Did not you tell me that you had dreamed me as a destroyer? That is my prediction. I will destroy the people who destroyed my child.
Where's the bottle?
He sounded utterly discouraged, and I decided to take mercy on him. We drank it. We've talked enough. Go to sleep.
I cannot. I fear to dream.
I was drunk. The words tumbled from my mouth. Then dream of me killing the four. I laughed stupidly. How I would have loved to kill Dwalia. I took a deep breath. Now I understand why you were angry at me for walking away from the pale woman. I knew she would die, but I understand why you wished me to kill her.
You were carrying me. I was dead.
Yes. We were both quiet for a time, thinking of that. I had not been this drunk in a long time. I started to let my awareness slide away.
Fitz, after my parents left me at Clara's, I was still a child. Just when I needed someone to care for me, to protect me, I had no one.
His voice, always controlled so carefully, was thickening with tears.
I journeyed to Buckkeep when I first fled Clara's to discover you. It was horrible. The things I had to do, the things that were done to me, all so that I could get to Buck and find you.
He sobbed in a breath.
Then King Shrewd, I came there hoping only to manipulate him to get what I needed. You, alive, I had become what the servants had taught me to be, ruthless and selfish, set only on levering people and events to my will. I came to his court, ragged and half-starved, and gave him a letter with most of the ink washed away, saying that I had been sent as a gift to him.
He sniffed and then dragged his arm across his eyes. My eyes filled with tears for him.
I tumbled and pranced and walked on my hands. I expected him to mock me. I was prepared to be used however he desired if I could but win your life from him.
He sobbed aloud.
He ordered me to stop. Regal was beside his throne, full of horror that a creature such as I was admitted to the throne room. But Shrewd, he told a guardsman,
take that child to the kitchens and see him fed. Have the seamstresses find some clothes to fit him.
And shoes. Put shoes on his feet. And all that he commanded was done for me. It made me so wary. Oh, I didn't trust him. Capra had taught me to fear initial kindness. I kept waiting for the blow, for the demand. When he told me I could sleep on the hearth in his bedchamber, I was certain he would. But that was all he meant. While Queen Desire was gone, I would be his companion in the evening, to amuse him with tricks and tales and songs, and then sleep on his hearth and rise in the morning when he did. Fitz, he had no reason to be so kind to me. None at all.
He was weeping noisily now, his walls completely broken.
He protected me, Fitz. It took months for him to gain my trust, but after a time, whenever Queen Desire was traveling and I slept on the hearth, I felt safe. It was safe to sleep.
He rubbed his eyes again.
I miss that. I miss that so badly.
I did, I think, what anyone would have done for a friend, especially as drunk as we both were. I remembered Burrick, too, and how his strength had sheltered me when I was small. I put my arm around the fool and pulled him close. For an instant, I felt that unbearable connection. I lifted my hand away and shifted so that his face rested on my shirt.
I felt that,
he said wearily. So did I.
You should be more careful.
I should. I secured my walls against him. I wished I didn't have to. Go to sleep, I told him. I made a promise I doubted I could keep. I will protect you. He sniffed a final time, wiped his wrist across his eyes, and gave a deep sigh. He groped with his gloved hand and clasped my hand, wrist to wrist, the warrior's greeting. After a time, I felt his body go slack against mine. His grip on my wrist loosened. I kept mine firm. Protect him. Could I even protect myself anymore? What right did I have to offer him such a vain promise? I hadn't protected B, had I? I took a deep breath and thought of her, not in the shallow, wistful way one recalls a sweet time long past. I thought of her little hand clasping my fingers. I recalled how thickly she spread butter on bread, and how she held her teacup in both hands. I let the pain wash fresh against me, salt in fresh slashes. I recalled her weight on my shoulder, and how she gripped my head to steady herself. B. So small. Mine for so short a time. And gone now. Just gone into the skill stream, and lost forever. B. The fall made a small sound of pain. For an instant, his hand tightened on my wrist, and then fell slack again. And for a time, as I stared up at the false night sky, I kept a drunken watch over him. Chapter 7. Beggar. A dream, so brief but so brilliantly coloured that I cannot forget it. Is it significant? My father is talking to a person with two heads. They are so deep in conversation that no matter how loudly I interrupt them, they will not speak to me. In the dream I say, "Find her! Find her! It's not too late!" In the dream I am a wolf made of fog. I howl and howl, but they do not turn to me. Dream Journal of B. Farcia. I had never been so alone, so hungry. Even Wolf Father was at a loss for what I should do. "Let us find a forest. There I can teach you to be a wolf, like your father taught me." The ruins were a great tumble of blackened and melted stone. The squared edges of some blocks were slumped and sunken like ice melted by the sun. I had to climb up and over collapsed walls, and I feared to fall into the cracks between the fallen stones. I found a place where two immense blocks were tented together and crawled into the shadowy recess beneath them. Huddled in their shade, I tried to gather my thoughts and strength. I needed to stay hidden from Dwalia and the others. I had no food and no water. I had the clothes on my back and a candle in my jerkin. My mildewed shawl had been lost in my most recent beating, along with my wool hat. How could I win my way back to Buck, or even to the border of the Six Duchies? I reviewed what I knew of the geography of Chaelsed. Could I walk home? Chaelsed's terrain was harsh. It was a land where heat welled up from the earth. There was a desert, I seemed to recall, and a low range of mountains. I shook my head. It was useless. My mind could not work while my belly clamored for food, and my mouth told me how dry it was. All that afternoon I remained hidden. I listened intently, but heard nothing of Dwalia and the others. Perhaps she had managed to exit the tumble of stone, and perhaps Vindelire had once more bent the Chaelsedian's will to her purposes. What would they do? Perhaps go into the city or to Kerf's home? Would they search for me? So many questions and no answers. As night approached, I picked my way through a dragon-blasted section of the city. Once fine houses gawked rooflessly, with empty holes for windows and doors. The streets had largely been cleared of rubble. Scavengers and salvagers had been at work among the ruins. Walls were missing blocks of stones. Tall weeds and scrawny bushes grew from the cracks. Beyond a gap in a tumbled garden wall, I found water collected in the mossy basin of a derelict fountain. I drank from my cupped hands and splashed my face. My raw wrists stung as I washed my hands. I pushed sprawling bushes aside as I sought a shelter for the night. The scent of crushed mint rose to me as I trod through herbs. I ate some of it, simply to have something in my belly. My brushing fingertips recognized the umbrella shapes of nasturtium leaves. I ripped up handfuls and stuffed them in my mouth. Beyond a curtain of trailing vines on a leaning trellis, I found an abandoned dwelling. I clambered through a low window and looked up at a roofless view of the sky. Tonight would be clear and cold. I found a corner relatively free of rubble and partially sheltered by the collapsed roof, crept into the darkness, and curled up like a stray dog there. I closed my eyes. Sleep came and went with intermittent dreams. I had toast and tea at Withywood's. My father carried me on his shoulders. I woke up weeping. I huddled tighter in the dark and tried to imagine a plan that would get me home. The floor was hard beneath me. My shoulders still ached. My belly hurt, not just from hunger, but from the kicks I'd received. I touched my ear. Blood crusted my hair around it. I probably looked frightful, as awful as the beggar I'd tried to help back in Oaks Bywater. So tomorrow, I'd be a beggar girl. Anything to get food. I pushed my back against the wall and huddled smaller. I slept fitfully through a night that was not that cold unless one was sleeping outside with no more cover than tattered clothing. When the sun rose, I discovered a blue sky full of scudding white clouds. I was stiff, hungry, thirsty, and alone. Free. A strange smell hung in the air, tinging the city smells of cook fires and open drains and horse droppings. "Low tide," Wolffather whispered to me. "The smell of the sea when the waves retreat." I clambered up what remained of the stone wall of the house to survey my surroundings. I was on a low hill in a great trough of a valley. I had glimpses of a river beyond the city below. Behind me, houses and buildings and roads coated the land like a crusty sore. Smoke rose from countless chimneys. Closer to the city, tendrils of brownish water surrounded the many ships at anchor. A harbour. I knew the word, but finally I saw all it meant. It was sheltered water, as if a finger and thumb of the land reached out to enclose it. Beyond it was more water, all the way to the edge of the sky. I had so often heard of the deep blue sea that it was hard to grasp that the many shaded waters of greens and blues, silver and greys and blacks were what minstrels sang about. The minstrels had sung, too, of the lure of the sea. But I felt nothing of that. It looked vast and empty and dangerous. I turned away from it. In the far distance beyond the city, there were low mounds of yellowish hills. "They have no forest," I whispered. "Ah, this explains much about the Chalcedians," Wolffather replied. Through my eyes he surveyed a land scarred with buildings and cobbled streets. "This is a different and dangerous sort of wilderness. I fear I will be of small use to you here. Go carefully, cub. Go very carefully." Chalced was waking. There were damaged swathes of city below me, but the dragons had concentrated their fury on the area around the ruined palace. "The Duke's palace," Kerf had said. Memory stirred. I had heard of this destruction in a conversation between my mother and father. The dragons of Kelsingrar had come to Chalced and attacked the city. The old duke had been destroyed, and his daughter had stepped up to become Duchess of Chalced. No one could recall a time when a woman had reigned over Chalced. My father had said, "I doubt there will be peace with Chalced, but at least they'll be so busy fighting civil wars that they can't bother us as much." But I saw no civil war. Brightly garbed folk moved in the peaceful lanes. Carts pulled by donkeys or peculiarly large goats began to fill the streets, and people in loose, billowing shirts and black trousers moved among them. I watched fish spilling silver from a boat pulled up on the shore, and saw a ship towed out to deep water where its sails spread like the sudden wings of a bird before it moved silently away. I saw two markets, one near the docks and another along a broad avenue. The latter had bright awnings over the stalls, while the one near the docks seemed drabber and poorer. The smells of fresh baked bread and smoked meats reached me, and faint though they were, my mouth watered. I assessed my plan to be a mute beggar girl and beg for coins and food, but my ragged tunic and leggings and fur boots would betray that I was a foreigner in this land of bright and flowing garb. I had no choice. I could stay hidden in the ruins and starve, or take my chances in the streets. I tidied myself. I would be a beggar, but not a disgusting one. I hoped that my pale hair and blue eyes would make me appear Chalcedian, and I could mind that I had no voice. I touched my face, wincing as I explored bruises and scarcely healed cuts. Perhaps pity would aid my cause, but I could not rely on pity alone. I took off the fur boots. The spring day was already too warm for them. I dusted and smoothed them as best I could. I peeled the rags of my stockings and stared at my pale and shriveled feet. I couldn't remember the last time I'd gone barefoot. I'd have to get used to it. I hugged my boots to my chest and began to walk toward the market. Where people sell things, there are people buying things. My feet were bruised by stones and dirty by the time I reached the market, but my hunger outshone those pains. It hurt to walk past the stalls selling early fruit and baked breads and meats. I ignored the odd looks people gave me and tried to appear calm and relaxed, rather than a stranger in this city. I found the stalls that sold fabric and garments, and then the carts that sold used clothing and rags. I offered the boots mutely to several booths before anyone showed any interest in them. The woman who took them from me turned them over and over. She frowned at them, scowled at me, looked at them again, and then held out 6 copper coins. I had no way to bargain. Good or bad, it was the only offer I'd get, and so I took the coins, bobbed a bow to her, and stepped back from her stall. I tried to fade into the passing folk, but I could feel her eyes following me. I silently offered 2 coins at a baker's stall. The vendor asked me a question, and I gestured at my closed mouth. The young man looked at the coins, looked at me, pursed his lips, and turned to a covered basket. He offered me a stiff roll of bread, probably several days old. I took it, my hands trembling with eagerness, and bobbed my head in thanks. A peculiar look crossed his face. He caught me by the wrist, and it was all I could do not to shriek. But then he chose from the fresh wares on the board in front of him the smallest of the sweet rolls and gave it to me. I think my look of utter gratitude embarrassed him, for he shooed me away as if I were a stray kitten. I stuffed my food into the front of my tunic with my battered candle and fled to find a safe place to eat it. At the end of the market row I saw a public well. I'd never seen the like. Warm water bubbled up into a stone-lined pool. The overflow was guided away in a trough. I saw women filling buckets, and then saw a child stoop and drink from cupped hands. I copied her, kneeling by the water and scooping up a drink. The water smelled odd and had a strong flavor, but it was wet and not poisonous, and that was all I cared about. I drank my fill, then splashed a bit onto my face and scrubbed my hands together. Evidently that was rude, for a man made a noise of disgust and scowled at me. I scrambled to my feet and hurried away. Beyond the market was a street of merchants. These were not market stalls, but grand establishments built of stone and timbers. Their doors were open to the warming day. As I walked past, I smelled meat curing in smoke, and then heard the rasp of a carpenter smoothing wood. There were stacks of rough timbers in an open space beside and behind the carpenter's shop. I looked both ways and then slipped into their shade. The cross-layered planks hid me from the street. I sat on the ground and set my back to a stack of sweet-smelling wood. I took out my bread and made myself eat the older roll first. It was coarse stuff and stale, and incredibly delicious. I trembled as I ate it. When it was gone, I sat still, breathing hard and feeling the last of the bread descend from my throat to my stomach. I could have eaten 10 more just like it. I held the small sweet roll in my hand and smelled it. I told myself I would be wise to save it for tomorrow. Then I told myself that as I carried it, I might drop it or break bits off it and lose them. I was easily persuaded. I ate it. There was a thin thread of honey swirled on top of it that had baked into the bread, and there were bits of fruit and spices inside it. I ate it in torturously slow nibbles, savoring every tingle of sweetness on my tongue. Too soon it was gone. My hunger was sated, but the memory of it plagued me. Another memory sifted into my brain, another beggar, scarred and broken and cold, probably hungrier than I was now. I had tried to be kind to him, and my father had stabbed him over and over, and then abandoned me to carry him off to Buckkeep for healing. I tried to put those bits together with the pieces I had overheard, but they only joined together in impossible ways. Instead, I wondered why no one looked at me, small, hungry, and alone, and offered me an apple. My mouth watered at the thought of the apple I'd given that beggar. Oh, the chestnuts that day, hot to peel and sweet in my mouth. My stomach knotted, and I bent over it. I had 4 small coins left. If the bread man was as kind tomorrow as he had been today, I could eat for 2 days. Then I'd either go hungry or steal. How was I going to get home? The sun was getting warmer and the day brighter. I looked down at myself. My bare feet were scuffed with dirt and my toenails were long. My padded trousers were grubby. My once long Withywood's green jerkin was spotted and stained and ended raggedly at my hips. My underblouse was grimy at the cuffs. A very convincing beggar. I should go down to the docks and see if any ships were bound to Buck, or indeed anywhere in the six duchies. I wondered how I could ask and what I could do to earn passage on one. The sun was bright and my clothing too warm for the mild day. I moved deeper into the shade and curled up with my back to a stack of wood. I did not mean to fall asleep, but I did. I woke in late afternoon. The shade had travelled away from me, but I had slept until the moving light of the sun on my closed eyes had woken me. I sat up, feeling miserably sick, dizzy, and thirsty. I staggered to my feet and began to walk. My small store of courage was gone. I could not make myself go down to the docks or even explore more of the city. I retreated to the ruins where I had sheltered the night before. In a city full of strangeness, I took comfort from what little I knew. By daylight, the water in the old fountain in the ruined house's garden was greenish, and little black water creatures darted in its depths. But it was water, and I was thirsty. I drank and then bared my body to wash as best I could. I rinsed out my clothes and was surprised at how hard a task that was. Once again, I realized how easy a life I'd led at Withywood's. I thought of the servants who had supplied my every need. I had always been polite to them, but had I ever truly thanked them for all they did? Caution came to mind, and how she had loaned me her lace cuffs. Was she still alive? Did Caution think of me sometimes? I wanted to weep, but did not. Sternly I made my plans as I dipped and scrubbed and wrung out my garments. Dwalia had thought me a boy. It was safer to present myself as a boy. Would a ship going toward the six duchies need a boy? I'd heard tales of ship's boys having wild and wonderful adventures. Some became pirates in the minstrel's songs, or found treasures, or became captains. Tomorrow I would take two of my coins and buy more bread and eat it. I very much liked that part of my plan. Then I must go down to the waterfront and see if any ships were going to the six duchies, and if they would give me passage for work. I pushed away the thought that I was small and looked childish and was not very strong and spoke no Chalcedian. Somehow, I would manage. I had to. I hung my clothing on a broken stone wall to dry and stretched out naked on the sun-warmed stones of a deserted courtyard. My mother's candle was battered, the wax imprinted with lint, and broken in that one place with only the wick holding it together. But it still smelled like her. Like home and safety and gentle hands. I fell asleep there in the dappling shade of a half-fallen tree. When I woke a second time, my clothing was mostly dry and the sun was going down. I was hungry again and dreaded the chill night. I had slept so much, but I still felt weary, and I wondered if my journey through the stone pillars had taken more from me than I knew. I crawled deeper under the leaning tree to where the leaves of several falls made a cushion against the stone. I refused to think of spiders and biting things. I curled up small and slept again. Sometime in the night, I lost my courage. My own crying woke me, and once awake, I could not stop the sobs. I stuffed my hand in my mouth to muffle the sounds and wept. I wept for my lost home, for the horses killed in the fire, for Revel dead in his blood on the floor before me. Everything that had happened to me, all that I had seen and had not had time to react to, suddenly flooded my mind. My father had left me for the sake of a blind beggar man, and Perseverance was probably dead. I'd left Shun behind and hoped the best for her. Had she survived and reached Withywood's to tell them what had befallen us? Would anyone ever come after me? I remembered FitzVigilant, his blood red on the white snow. Suddenly, going home seemed impossible. Going home to what? Who would be there? Would they all hate me because the pale folk had come for me? And if I went home, would not Dwalia or others of her kind know where I would flee? Would they come after me again, to burn and kill? I hunched low under my sheltering tree, rocking myself, knowing that there was no one who could protect me.
I'll protect you.
Wolffather's words were less than a whisper. He was only in my mind, only an idea. How could he protect me? What was he, really? Something I imagined from the fragments of my father's writing.
I am real, and I am with you. Trust me. I can help you protect yourself.
I felt a sudden rush of anger. You didn't protect me before, when they took me. You didn't protect me when Dwalia beat me and dragged me through the pillar. You're a dream, something I imagined because I was so childish and scared. But you can't help me now. No one can help me now.
No one except yourself.
Be silent! I shouted the words, and then covered my mouth in horror. I needed to hide, not shout at imaginary beings in the night. I scuttled deeper under the tree until I felt a tumble of fallen wall and could go no farther. I made myself small and shut my eyes tight and walled my thoughts in and slept. I woke the next day with my face crusty from my weeping. My head pounded with pain, and I felt nauseous with hunger. It was a long time before I could convince myself to crawl out from the tree's shade. I did not feel well enough to walk down to the markets, so I wandered the ruined area of the city. I caught sight of lizards and snakes basking on the tumbled stones. I thought of eating one, but at my approach they whisked under the stones. Twice I saw other people who seemed to be living in the broken houses. I smelled their cook fires and saw ragged clothing hung to dry. I kept out of their sight. Hunger drove me at last back to the market. I could not find the bread stall I'd patronized the day before. I staggered and limped through the stalls, looking for it, but finally my raging hunger forced me to approach another. A sour-faced woman was cooking pastries stuffed with some savory filling on a griddle. A small metal pot held her cook fire. The pastries sizzled in a wide pan over the flames, and she deftly flipped them with a pronged tool to brown each side. I offered her one coin, and she shook her head. I wandered off behind a stall where I could extract another coin from my knotted shirt. For two coins, she put a pastry on a wide green leaf, folded the leaf around it, secured it with a sliver of wood, and handed it to me. I bowed my thanks, but she ignored that, already looking over my head for her next potential customer. I did not know if the leaf was meant to be eaten or was a napkin. I took a cautious nibble of the edge. It was not unpleasant. I reasoned that a vendor would not wrap food in something poisonous. I found a quiet place behind an unoccupied market stall and sat down to eat. The pastry was not large, just filling my hand. I wanted to eat it slowly. The filling was crumbly and tasted a bit like wet sheep smelled. I didn't care. But after my second bite, I became aware of a boy watching me from the gap between the walls of two stalls. I looked away from him, taking another bite, and when I glanced back, a smaller boy in a dirty striped shirt had joined him. Their hair and their feet and bare legs were dusty, their clothing unkempt. They had the eyes of small, hungry predators. I felt a moment of dizziness as I stared at them. It reminded me of when the beggar at Oaks Bywater had held my hand. I saw events swirling, possibilities. I could not sort them, could not tell good from bad. All I knew for certain was that I must avoid them. As a donkey cart passed between us, I scooted around the corner of the stall and stuffed the rest of my pastry in my mouth, overfilling it, but freeing my hands. I rose and tried to blend in with the passing folk. My clothing made me stand out, so that I drew curious glances. I kept my eyes down and tried not to engage anyone's attention. I glanced back several times, but did not see the boys, yet I was convinced they were following me. If they robbed me of my two remaining coins, I would have nothing. I fought down the panic that thought brought.
Don't think like prey.
A warning from Wolffather, or simply a thought of my own? I slowed my steps, found a place to crouch beside a refuse cart, and watched the ebb and flow of people. There were others like me in the market, and those young beggars were more skilled at this trade. Three youngsters, two girls and a boy, lingered at a fruit vendor's stall, despite his efforts to shoo them away. Suddenly, all three darted in, each seizing a prize, and then they scattered while the seller shouted and cursed and sent his son chasing after one of them. I saw, too, some sort of city guards. Their orange robes were cut short to their knees, and they wore canvas trousers, light leather tunics, and low boots. They carried short, knobbed staves, and wore sheathed swords as they strode past in groups of four. Merchants offered them skewers of meat and rolls of bread and chunks of fish on flatbread as they passed. I wondered if gratitude or fear prompted such generosity, and slipped away from their view as quickly as I could. I made my way eventually to the docks. It was a noisy, busy place. Men were pushing handcarts, teams of horses pulled laden wagons, with some going to the ships and others coming from them. The smells were overwhelming. Tar and rotting seaweed predominated. I hung back, watching and wondering how to tell where a ship was going. I had no desire to be carried even farther from the six duchies. I watched wide-eyed as an apparatus I could not name lifted a net that held several large wooden crates and swung them from the dock to a ship's deck. I saw a young man receive three sharp cracks from a stick across his bared back, even as he was guiding such a swinging cargo down to a deck. I could not tell what he had done wrong or why he had been struck and shrank back, imagining such blows falling on me. I saw no one as small as me working on the docks, though I guessed that several of the boys I saw were my age. They worked shirtless, darting barefoot on the splintery docks, on apparently urgent missions that demanded they run. One boy had an oozing welt down his back. A cart driver shouted at me to get out of his way, and another man did not bother, shoving me aside, shoulders laden with two heavy coils of rope. Daunted, I fled through the market and then up the hill toward the ruins. As I left the market, a young man in a lovely robe, decorated with rosettes of yellow, called to me with a smile. He beckoned me closer, and when I halted at a safe distance, wondering what he wanted of me, he crouched down to my height. He cocked his head and said something softly, persuasive words that I did not understand. He looked kind. His hair was more yellow than mine and cut so that it barely reached his jaw. His earrings were green jade. A man of a good family and wealth, I guessed. "I don't understand," I replied hesitantly in common. His blue eyes narrowed in surprise, and then his smile widened. In a heavy accent, he said, "Pretty new robe. Come, give you food." He eased a step closer to me, and I could smell his perfumed hair. He held out his hand, palm upturned, and waited for me to take it.
"Run, run now."
Wolffather's urgency brooked no hesitation. I gave the smiling man a final glance, a shake of my head, and I darted away. I heard him call after me, and I wondered why I ran. But run I did. He called after me again, but I did not look back.
"Do not go straight to your den. Hide and look back,"
Wolffather cautioned me, and so I did, but saw no one. Later that night, curled under my sheltering tree, I wondered why I had fled.
"Eyes of a predator," Wolffather told me.
"What should I do tomorrow?" I asked him.
"I don't know,"
was his woeful response. I dreamed of home that night, of toasted bread and hot tea in the kitchen. In my dream, I was too small to reach the top of the table, and I could not right the overturned bench. I called to Caution to help me, but when I turned to look for her, she was lying on the floor with blood all over her. I ran from the kitchen screaming, but everywhere folk were dead on the floor. I opened doors to try to hide, but behind each door were the two beggar boys, and beyond them, Dwalia stood, laughing. I woke sobbing in the middle of the night. To my terror, I heard voices, one calling questioningly. I muffled my sobs and tried to breathe silently. I saw a dim light and a lantern passed by in the street outside my broken garden. Two people spoke to each other in Chalcedian. I stayed hidden and wakeful until morning. The morning was half gone before I found the courage to return to the market. I found the bread stall I'd visited the first day, but the young man had been replaced by a woman, and when I showed her my two coins, she gestured me away in disgust. I held them both up again, thinking she had seen only the one, but she hissed a rebuke at me and slapped her hands together threateningly. I retreated, resolved to find food elsewhere, but in that instant I was knocked down by one of the two boys I'd seen the day before. In a flash, the other boy snatched my coins and they both darted away into the market throng. I sat up in the dust, the wind knocked out of me. Then, to my shame, sobs shook me, and I sat in the dirt and covered my eyes and wept. No one cared. The flow of the market went around me as if I were a stone in the current. For a time after my sobbing left me, I sat forlorn. I was so terribly hungry. My shoulder ached, the relentless sun shone on my aching head, and I had no plans left. How could I imagine getting home when I could not think how to get through the day? A man guiding a donkey cart through the market tapped me with his quirt. It was a warning, not a strike, and I quickly scrabbled out of his way. I watched him pass and smeared dust and tears from my face onto my sleeve and looked around the market. The hunger that assailed me now seemed the product of weeks rather than just a day. While I'd had the prospect each day of something to eat, however small, I'd been able to master it. But now it commanded me. I squared my shoulders, wiped my eyes once more, and then walked deliberately away from the bread stall. I moved slowly through the market, studying each stall and vendor. My moral dilemma lasted as long as it took for me to swallow the saliva the smells of the foods triggered. Yesterday, I'd seen how it was done. I had no one to create a diversion for me, and if anyone decided to pursue me, I would be the only rabbit to be run down. My hunger seemed to speed my thought processes. I'd have to choose a stall and a target and an escape route. Then I'd have to wait and hope that something would distract the merchant. I was small and I was fast. I could do this. I had to do this. Hunger such as I felt now could not be borne. I prowled the market, intent on my theft. Nothing small. I did not want to take this chance for a bit of fruit. I needed meat or a loaf of bread or a side of smoked fish. I tried to look without appearing to look, but a small boy lifted a switch threateningly at me when I stared too long at his mother's slabs of red salted fish. I finally found what I sought, a baker's stall, bigger and grander than any other I'd seen. Loaves of rich brown and golden yellow were mounded in baskets on the ground in front of his stall. On the plank before him were the more expensive wares, bread twisted with spices and honey, rich cakes studded with nuts. I'd settle for one of the golden yellow pillows. The stall next to him sold scarves that billowed in the breeze off the sea. Several women were clustered there, their bargaining focused and intense. Across the milling market street, a tinker sold knives. His partner sharpened blades of all sorts on a spinning whetstone powered by a sweating apprentice. The grinding made a shrill sound, and sometimes it spat sparks. I found a backwater of the customer stream and pretended a great fascination with the spinning stone. I let my mouth hang a trifle ajar as if I did not have all my mind. I was sure that with such an expression and my ragged clothes, folk would pay little attention to me. But all the while, I waited for anything in the market that might make the bread vendor look away from his wares and give me a chance to steal my target. As if in answer to my thoughts, I heard distant horns. All glanced in that direction and then went back to their business. The next blast of the horn was closer. People turned again, nudging one another, and finally we saw four white horses decked out in fine harness of black and orange. The guards who rode the horses were just as richly attired, their helms as plumed as their horses' headstalls. They rode toward us, and the clusters of buyers pushed against the stands to get out of their way. As the riders again lifted their horns to their mouths, I saw my chance. All were watching them as I darted in, seized a round golden loaf, and then darted back the way the horsemen had come. So intent had I been on my theft that I had not perceived that behind the horsemen the market street had remained empty, and that the folk who lined the street had dropped to their knees. I ran, skittering out into the empty street as the bread merchant shouted. When I tried to dart back into the kneeling crowd to lose myself among them, people grabbed at me, shouting. Another set of guards was coming on foot, marching in a row of six, with two more rows behind them, and behind them came a woman on a black horse with harness of gold. The kneeling folk were packed as solidly as a wall. I tried to push into them. A man grabbed me with hard hands and pushed me down in the dirt. He growled at me, a command I did not understand. I struggled to rise, and he slapped me sharply on the back of my head. I saw stars and went slack. An instant later, I realized that everyone around me was frozen into stillness. Had he bid me be still? I lay as he had pushed me. The loaf I had stolen was clutched to my chest and chin. The smell of it was dizzying. I did not think. I tucked my head and opened my mouth and bit into it. I lay on my belly in the dusty street and gnawed at the loaf like a mouse, as first the ranks of guards and then the woman on her black horse and then another four ranks of guards passed. No one moved until a second rank of horsemen came. At intervals, they halted and rang brass chimes. Only after they had passed did the nearby merchants and buyers rise to their feet and resume their lives. I waited, chewing busily into my bread, and the moment the chimes rang, I bucked to my feet and tried to run. But the man who had held me down snatched the back of my jerkin and gripped my hair. He shook me and shouted something. The bread merchant came dashing over, snatched the bread out of my hand, and cried out to find it dirty and chewed. I cringed, thinking he would hit me, but instead he began to shout one word over and over. He threw the bread down in anger, and how I longed to snatch it up again, but my captor held me fast. The city guard, that was who he was shouting for, and two came on the run. One smirked and looked at me almost kindly, as if he could not believe he had been summoned for such a small thief. But the other was a businesslike fellow who seized me by the back of my tunic and all but lifted me off my feet. He began to ask me questions, and the bread man began to shout his side of the story. I shook my head and then gestured at my mouth, trying to convey that I could not speak. I think it was going well, until the kind guardsman leaned close to his fellow, and then suddenly gave me such a pinch that I squeaked. Then it was all over. I was shaken, and when the guardsman who held me lifted his hand to slap me, I burst out in common, "I was hungry, so I stole. What else was I to do? I am so hungry." Then, shaming myself, I burst into tears and pointed at the bread and strained toward it. The man who had caught me first stooped and picked it up and put it into my hands. The breadman attempted to slap it away from me, but the guardsman who still held me swung me out of his reach. Then, to complete my humiliation, he picked me up and perched me on his hip, as if I were a much younger child, and strode off through the market. I gripped the bread in both hands. I could not control my tears or my sobs, but that did not stop me from eating the bread as fast as I could get it down. I had no idea what might happen to me next, but decided that one thing I would be sure of. I would fill my belly with the bread that had gotten me into so much trouble. I was still clutching the last of the crust when my carrier strode up three steps to the door of an unremarkable stone building. He pushed open the door, carried me inside, and then swung me to the floor as his partner followed. An older man in a fancier livery looked up from a table as we came in. His noon meal was spread out before him, and he looked rather annoyed to be interrupted. They spoke about me over my head as I looked around the room. There was a bench down one plain wall. A woman sat on it. Her feet were chained together. At the other end of the bench, a man sat hunched with his face in his hands. He glanced up at me, and his mouth was all blood and one eye was swollen shut. He put his face back in his hands. The guard who had carried me seized me by the shoulder and shook me. I looked up at them. He spoke to me. I shook my head. The man behind the desk spoke to me. I shook my head again. Then, in common, he asked me, "Who are you? Are you lost, child?" At the simple question, I burst into tears again. He looked mildly alarmed. He made shooing motions at the two guards and they left. As the one went out the door, he looked back at me, almost as if he were concerned for me. But the man at the table was talking again. "Tell me your name. Your parents could pay for what you stole and take you home." Was that even possible? I drew a breath. "My name is B. Farsier. I'm from the Six Duchies. I was stolen from there, and I need to go home." I took a breath and made a wild promise. "My father will pay money to get me back."
"I've no doubt that he will."
The man leaned one elbow on his desk, right next to a little round cheese. I stared at it. He cleared his throat.
"How did you come to be running about on the streets of Chalesed, B. Farsier?"
He made my name one word. I didn't correct him. It didn't matter. If he would listen to me and send word to my father, I knew he would pay money to get me back. Or Nettle would. Surely she would. And so I told him my story, doing my best to leave out the unbelievable parts. I told him of Chalesedians raiding my home and how I'd been carried off. I didn't explain how I'd come to Chalesed, only that I'd slipped away from Kerf and his companions because they had been cruel to me. And now I was here, and I only wanted to go home, and if he would send word to my father, I was sure someone would come and bring money and take me home. He looked a bit puzzled by my stew of a story, but nodded gravely at the end.
"Well, I understand now, perhaps better than you do."
He rang a bell on the corner of his desk. A door opened and a sleepy-looking guardsman came in. He
He was very young and looked bored.
Runaway slave. Property of someone named Kerf. Take her to the end cell. If no one claims her in 3 days, take her to the auction. Price of a loaf of pollen bread is owed to Searching the Baker. Make a note that this Kerf must either pay for it, or the price come out of whatever she fetches at auction.
I'm not a slave, I protested. Kerf does not own me. He helped steal me from my home.
The deskman looked at me tolerantly. Spoil of war, prize of battle, you are his, whatever he chooses to call you. He can keep you as slave or ransom you back. That will be up to this Kerf if he comes to claim you.
He settled himself back in his chair with a sigh and took a deep drink from his cup. My tears started again. Despite how useless they were, the bored guard looked down on me.
Follow me,
he said in clear common, and when I turned and bolted for the door, he stepped forward, tripped me, and laughed. He picked me up by the back of my jerkin as if I were a sack, and carried me through the same door he'd entered from, not caring at all how he thudded me against the frame. He kicked it shut behind us, tossed me to the floor, and said,
You can follow me, or I can kick you all the way down this hallway. It's all one to me.
It was not all one to me. I stood, gave him a stiff nod, and then followed him. We went around a corner and down some stone steps. It was cooler down there, and dimmer. The only light came from some small windows at intervals in the wall. I followed him past several doors. He opened the last one and said,
Get in there.
I hesitated, and he gave me a shove and shut the door behind me. I heard it latch. The room was small, but not terrible. Light came from a very small window. It was so small that even if I could have reached it, I couldn't have wriggled out. There was a woven straw mat in one corner. In the opposite corner, there was a hole in the floor. Stains and the smell told me what it was for. Next to the mat was a ewer. It had water in it. I sniffed it to be sure it was water. I dipped the hem of my shirt into it and wiped the stupid tears from my face. Then I went and sat down on the straw mat. I sat for a long time. Then I lay down. I might have slept a bit. I heard the latch work and stood up. A man opened the door carefully, looking all around and then down at me. He seemed surprised at how small I was.
Food,
he said, and handed me a crockery bowl. I was so surprised I just stood there, clutching it as he left, closing the door behind him. When he was gone, I looked down in the bowl. It was grainy mush, with a few pieces of an orange vegetable on top of it. I carried it back to my mat and ate it carefully with my fingers. Someone had put enough for an adult in the bowl. It was the most food I'd had in a very long time. I tried to eat it very slowly and to think what I should do next. When the food was gone, I drank some water and then wiped my fingers clean on my shirt hem. The light coming into my little room was getting dimmer. I wondered if anything else would happen, but it didn't. When my cell was dark, I lay down on my mat and closed my eyes. I thought of my father. I imagined what he would have done to the guards. Or Dwalia. I imagined him throttling her and clenched my own fists and panted at how satisfying that would be. He would teach them. He would kill them all for me. But my father was not here. He could not know where I was. No one was coming to save me. I cried for a time, and then slept, clutching my mother's candle. When I woke, there was a small square of light on the floor of my little room. I used the hole in the floor and drank some more water. I waited. Nothing happened. After what seemed like a long time, I shouted and pounded on the door. Nothing happened. When I couldn't shout or pound any more, I sat on my mat. I reached for Wolffather and could not find him. It was a very bad moment. I decided he had always been something I pretended. And now I was too old, and the world was too real for me to pretend anything any more.
When I need you, you are gone, just like everyone else. When you block me out, I cannot make you hear me.
I blocked you out?
When you close your thoughts. So here we are, in a cage again. At least your captors are kind. For now.
For now?
You will be sold.
I know. What should I do?
For now, eat. Sleep. Let your body heal.
When they take you out of here to sell, be very aware of me. We may yet escape. His words gave me very little hope, but before I'd had no hope at all. I cried until I slept that night. When I woke the next morning, I felt better than I had in many days. I inspected the bruises on my legs and arms. They were yellow and pale green, fading from black and deep blue. My belly hurt less, and I could move my arm in a full circle. I combed my growing hair with my fingers and then chewed my fingernails shorter. Another guard brought me a bowl of food and filled my water ewer. He took the empty bowl away. He didn't speak to me. It was another big bowl of food. This time the mush had some stringy strands of greens cooked into it, and there was a lump of yellow vegetable on top. I ate it all, then watched the square of light move across my floor and up the wall and until it was gone. Night again. I cried again and slept again. I dreamed that my father was angry because I had not put my inks away. I woke up while it was still dark, knowing that something like that had never happened, but wishing it could. I fell back to sleep and dreamed an important dream about a swimming dragon who captured my father. I woke to the square of light and wished I could write the dream down, but there was nothing I could write on, and no ink or pen. I spent the afternoon devising a way to tie my folded candle into the hem of my underblouse so it would not be lost. That day passed. Another bowl of food. Would they auction me soon? How did they count the 3 days? Did they start the day they caught me, or the day after? I wondered who would buy me and what sort of work I'd have to do. Would I be able to convince them to send word to my father? Perhaps I'd be sold as a house slave and could convince the buyers to ransom me. I'd heard of slaves, but had no idea how they were treated. Would they beat me? Keep me in a kennel? I was still wondering those things when I heard the latch to my door rattle. A guard opened it and then stepped back.
"This one?" he asked someone, and Kerf stuck his head around the door. He stared at me dully. I almost felt glad to see him. Then I heard Dwalia's voice.
"That's the little wretch. What a trouble she has been."
"She?"
The guard was surprised.
"We thought it was a boy."
"So did we," exclaimed Vindalaya. "He is my brother."
He poked his head past the doorframe and smiled at me. His cheeks were not as plump as they had been, and his sparse hair was dull, but the light of friendship was still in his eyes. I hated him. They never would have found me if he had not mastered Kerf for Dwalia. He'd betrayed me. The guard stared at him.
"Your brother! I see the resemblance," he said.
But no one laughed. I felt sick.
"I don't know those people," I said. "They're lying to you."
The guard shrugged.
"I don't really care, as long as someone settles you fine."
He swung his gaze back to Kerf.
"She got caught stealing a loaf of pollen bread. You'll have to pay for it."
Kerf nodded dully. I knew that Vindalaya was controlling him, but not too well. Kerf seemed very dim, as if he had to think carefully before he could speak. Elik had always seemed very sure of himself. Was Vindalaya losing his magic, or was something going wrong with Kerf? Perhaps the 2 trips through the stone had done it.
"I will pay," he said at last.
"Pay first, then you can take her. You owe for 4 days of her keep here, too."
They shut my door and walked away. I felt a twinge of gladness that they would cheat him for extra days, and then worried that perhaps I had been here 4 days and had lost track of time. I waited for them to come back, dreading that I'd be with them again, but almost relieved that someone else would be in charge of me. It seemed to take a long time, but eventually I heard the latch lift.
"Come along,"
Dwalia snapped at me.
"You are far more trouble than you are worth."
Her eyes promised a beating later, but Vindalaya was smiling fatuously at me. I wished I knew why he liked me. He was my worst enemy, but also my only ally. Kerf had seemed to like me, but if Vindalaya held his reins, I had no hope of help from him. Perhaps I should try to build my friendship with Vindalaya. Perhaps if I had been wiser, I would have done that from the very start.
Dwalia had a long coil of light cord. Before I could protest, she looped it around my neck.
No!
I cried, but she jerked it tight. When I reached for it, Kerf took my left hand, and she seized my right and turned it up behind my back. I felt a loop of the cord coil around my wrist. She was very quick at doing it. Doubtless she had done this before. My hand was uncomfortably high, and I could not lower it without tightening the loop around my neck. She held the end of the line in her hand. She gave it an experimental tug, and I had to jerk my head back.
"There we are," she said with great satisfaction. "No more little tricks from you. Off we go."
After the cool dimness of my cell, the bright day was painful and soon too warm for me. Kerf and Dwalia walked in front of me, my leash barely slack. I had to hurry to keep up with them. Vindalaya trotted beside me. It struck me how oddly he was made, with his bean-shaped body and short legs. I recalled how Dwalia had called him sexless. I wondered if she had castrated him, like the men did our goats when they wanted to raise them for meat, or had he been born that way? "Where is Alaria?" I asked him quietly. He gave me a miserable look.
"Sold to a slaver. For money for food and passage on a boat."
Kerf gave a twitch.
"She was mine. I wanted to take her to my mother. She would have been a good serving wench. Why did I do that?" "Vindalaya!"
Dwalia snapped. This time I opened my senses and I felt what he did to Kerf. I tried to understand it. I knew how to put up my walls to keep out my father's thoughts. I'd had to do that since I was small, just to have peace in my own mind. But it felt as if Vindalaya pushed a wall into Kerf's mind, one that kept out Kerf's thoughts and made him share what Vindalaya thought. I pushed against Vindalaya's wall. It was not that strong, but I was not sure how to breach it. Still, I heard a whisper of what he told Kerf.
"Don't worry. Go with Dwalia. Do what she wants. Don't wonder about anything. It will all be fine. Don't touch his mind. Don't break his wall."
The warning came from Wolffather.
"Listen, but don't let him feel you there."
"Why?"
"If you make a way into his thoughts, it's also a way for him to come into yours. Be very careful of touching his mind."
"Where are we going?" I asked aloud.
"Shut up,"
Dwalia said, just as Vindalaya said.
"To the boat for our journey."
I went quiet, but not because of Dwalia's order. For just a moment I had sensed that it was hard for Vindalaya to talk, trot at Dwalia's heels, and control Kerf. He was hungry, his back hurt, and he needed to relieve himself, but he knew better than to ask Dwalia to pause. As I kept my silence, I felt his focus on Kerf grow tighter and stronger. So, a distraction might weaken his control. That was a small but useful thing to know. Wolffather's voice was a bare whisper in my mind.
"Sharp claws and teeth. You learn, cub. We will live."
"Are you real?"
He did not answer, but Vindalaya cocked his head and stared at me strangely.
"Walls up. Keep him out of my mind."
I would always have to be on guard now. I tightened my guard on myself and knew that when I shut out Vindalaya, I shut out Wolffather as well.
Chapter 8. Tintaglia.
This dream was like a painting that moved. The light was dim, as if pale grey or blue paint had been washed over all. Beautiful streamers in brilliant colours moved in a slow breeze that came and went, so that the streamers rose and fell. They were shimmering pennants of gold and silver, scarlet, azure, and viridian. Bright patterns like diamonds or eyes and twining spirals ran the length of each pennant. In my dream, I moved closer, flowing effortlessly toward them. There was no sound and no feel of wind on my face. Then my perspective shifted. I saw huge snake heads, blunt-nosed, with eyes as large as melons.
I came closer and closer, although I did not wish to, and finally I could see the faint gleam of a net that held all those creatures as fish are caught in a gill net. The lines of the net were nearly transparent, and somehow I knew that they had all rushed into the net at the same moment to be trapped and drowned there. This dream had the certainty of a thing that had happened, and not just once. It would happen again and again. I could not stop it, for it was already done. Yet I also knew it would happen again. Dream Journal of B. Farsia. Early the next morning, there was a knock on our chamber door. I rolled from the bed and then stood. The fool did not even twitch. Barefoot, I padded to the door. I paused to push my hair back from my face, and then opened it. Outside, King Rain had flung back the hood of his cloak, and it dripped water on the floor around him. Rain gleamed on his brow and was caught in droplets in his sparse beard. He grinned at me, white teeth incongruous in his finely scaled face.
"Fitzchivalry! Good tidings, and I wanted to share them right away. A bird just came in from across the river. Tarmon has arrived there."
Across the river? A brandy headache had begun a sudden clangor in my head.
"At the village. It's far easier for the barge to nose in there than to dock here, and it's much better for Captain Leftrin to offload cargo there than have us ferry it across the river a bit at a time. Tarmon had a full load. Workers for the farm, a dozen goats, sacks of grain, 3 dozen chickens. We hope the goats will fare better than the sheep did. The sheep were a disaster. I think only 3 survived the winter. This time we will keep the chickens penned."
He cocked his head and apologized.
"Sorry for waking you so early, but I thought you'd want to know. The ship will need cleaning before it's fit for passengers. A day, perhaps 2, 3 at worst. But soon you'll be able to depart."
"Welcome news indeed," I told him. I reached past my headache to dredge up courtesy. "Although your hospitality has been wonderful, we look forward to continuing our journey." He nodded, scattering droplets.
"There are others that I must notify. Forgive me that I must go in haste."
And off he went, dripping down the corridor. I tried to imagine Dutiful delivering such a message to a guest. I watched him go and felt a twinge of envy for how spontaneously the dragon traders seemed to interact. Perhaps I'd had it backward all along. Perhaps being a bastard had given me far more freedom than living within the rules that bound a prince. I shut the door as the fool crawled to the edge of the bed.
"What was that?"
he asked unhappily. "King Rain with news. The Tarmon is docked across the river. We will depart in a day or two." He swung his legs over the edge of the bed, sat up, and then leaned forward, his head in his hands.
"You got me drunk,"
he complained. I was so tired of lying. "There are things I have to know. One way or another, fool, you need to talk to me." He moved slowly, lifting his head from his hands cautiously.
"I'm very angry with you,"
he said quietly,
"but I should have expected this."
He lowered his face back into his hands. His next words were muffled.
"Thank you."
He clambered from the bed, moving as if his brains might spill out of his skull, and spoke in Amber's voice.
"Tamara has requested my time for a visit. I think she is exceedingly curious about the silver on my hands and how it affects me. I think today I will call on her. Would you summon Spark to help me dress?"
"Of course." I noticed she did not ask me to accompany her. I supposed I deserved that. That afternoon, when the rain eased, I ventured out with Lant. I wished to see the map tower. I had first seen it many years ago when I had accidentally stumbled through a skillstone and into Kelsingrar. The fine maps that Shade and Ketrican had given me had not survived the bear attack. I hoped to refresh what I recalled with a look at that elderling map. but we had not walked far when I heard the wild trumpeting of dragons, and then the shouts of excited people.
"What is it?"
Lant asked me, and in the next breath,
"We should return to the others."
"No. Those are welcoming shouts. A dragon returns, one that has been long absent." A trick of the wind had brought a name to my ears. "Tintaglia returns," I told him, "and I would see her again." "Tintaglia," he said in hushed awe. His eyes were wide.
"Riddle spoke of her, the queen dragon who came to help free Icefire and then rose as his mate. She who forced Icefire to lay his head upon the hearthstones in Queen Eliania's mother house, to fulfill the challenge that Eliania had set for Dutiful."
"You know all that?"
"Fits. It's known to every child in the six duchies. Hap Gladheart sings that song about the dragons, the one that has the line, 'Bluer than sapphires, gleaming like gold.' I have to see her for myself."
"I think we shall," I shouted at him, for a wild chorus of dragons trumpeting now drowned our voices. They had risen from the city in greeting or challenge. It was an astonishing sight, beauty and terror mingling equally. They cavorted like swallows before a storm, but these were creatures